Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Of July, the sun is rising and the tomb is empty. And we say that each morning as we begin these shows on Faith Radio Mornings as a reminder that regardless of what's happening in this world, we serve a king of a living kingdom that has no end. And hopefully what's true about that, among many other things, is that as confusing as life can get, as hard as the headlines might seem, whatever is going on, there's always hope and there's always future in the beautiful kingdom of Jesus. And this is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Peter Kapsner, joined as always by the ever-capable Logan Rapp. On the sound and the board. Good morning, Logan.
That's a very high praise and probably misplaced.
Well, we'll go with it anyway. So, you know, it's early. There's optimism for the day, right? And Paul Perot in the newsroom and Rachel Sutton booking the show. And top of the mind stuff, at least for me driving in, was the story that you probably were following this weekend too, Logan and Paul, with the boys trapped in the cave in Thailand. And Paul, there's some updates happening just sort of as we speak, right?
Well, some good news. The fifth of the 12 boys has been pulled out. So he's out. He's safe. He's being taken to the hospital to be evaluated and such. So seven more boys to go and their coach, but they're in the process. They started the process of getting them out again. So
it's been incredible. I mean, look, I don't know if you've been following much of this, but it's an arduous trip just to even get to them. We're talking 6 hours to get. Is it back and forth one direction? I just know how long it is taking to get to these boys.
I think they're saying it's 6 hours to swim out of the cave. And that's not just swimming through a pool. I mean, that's swimming in water while inching your way through these caverns. I mean, it's airtight at some places. What is it? The one area 15 inches across?
15 inches. There's a section where it just really... If anything makes you want to not take up spelunking, this story does for me. That's all I can say.
No, for sure. I'm just amazed. And as of last week, many of these boys couldn't even swim. And now they're asked to go through these harrowing passageways as sort of a break for life at this point. And one of the things that really caught my attention this weekend was the other-centered bravery of these SEALs and how they're willing to risk life and limb for these young boys that we don't know. And it actually was a little bit confrontative in a good way, in a helpful way on my own faith, where so often My following Jesus has to do a sort of self-help or self-benefit, but really the heart of the kingdom is this other-centered desire to help other people, and they're manifesting that. I'm not saying believers, not believers. It just was this, whoa, what am I doing with my Christian journey on this?
I mean, that's the selfless act of righteousness that you could only possibly imagine, and that's obviously a call to us. Now, we're not necessarily trained Navy SEAL divers that can go out and save lives, but that mentality of regardless of how dangerous the situation is or how fearful I am of what should happen, that willingness to go forth and just do it because you know that's what you're called to do and you're the one who can bring help to others.
Yeah, super inspiring stuff coming out there. We'll keep you updated if events unfold and as they warrant this morning on the show. And we do have a great show ahead. I know our first guest had an opportunity to tape an interview with Ken Barnes, who released a book titled Redeeming Capitalism, and really important time to bring this topic to mind again, especially as there has been a movement towards socialism in our country and just trying to go back and forth. I think everybody recognizes that capitalism can have its problems. And the question is what do we do about that? And of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is sort of leading the socialistic movement. But Barnes would suggest that we need to redeem the soul of capitalism. It's a great book, really worth listening to the interview and his thoughts that he has. So we'll take a short break and be right back with Ken Barnes. Good morning. You are listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner, and joined this morning by Dr. Ken Barnes, who is a Mockler Phillips Professor of Workplace Theology and Business Ethics at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Tell me, what does that mean exactly, Ken? What is the work that you do with Gordon-Conwell?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I do a combination of things. I really have two titles. The professorship is a teaching position, so I actually teach courses that relate to the intersection of theology and ethics and economics and work, faith at work, those sorts of things. And then I'm also the director of the Mockler Center for Workplace Theology and Business Ethics, which is more of a think tank and a platform for various like-minded people who want to bring a Christian voice to the world of faith, work, and economics.
And you just recently released a book called, a very compelling title, of Redeeming Capitalism, obviously suggesting that maybe there are some things we need to think about relative to our historic economic system in our country. And one of the first thoughts I had when I saw the title was the idea that in the recent election cycle, we obviously saw quite a bit of grassroots support for Bernie Sanders. And some of the recent statistics are that upwards of 40% of people support the idea of socialism in our country. And it seems like maybe that's less about an understanding of socialism and more about a backlash towards what perhaps have been the failures of capitalism. So is at the heart of you releasing this book?
Yeah, it really is. You know, I have a whole chapter on alternative systems, and I talk about Bernie Sanders, and I talk about Thomas Piketty and the Wall Street movement that took place after the global financial crisis. So there is a lot of dissatisfaction with capitalism for good reason. You know, capitalism is a wonderful thing, and I often remind people that the title of the book is not replacing capitalism. It's not my suggestion at all. Capitalism is by far the most efficient wealth-creating system that has ever been devised by man. But capitalism isn't perfect, and capitalism needs a moral compass. What I say in the beginning of the book is that capitalism is a subject, not an object. In other words, capitalism is simply the word we use to describe an economic system that is very lightly regulated, that is very well financed, and that is basically reliant on free market exchange, individually and corporately. And so that system has worked well to create a lot of global wealth. It's done well to raise living standards, everything to do with longevity, with the quality of life, access to education, health care, fresh water. It depends where in the world you're talking about. Capitalism's done a great job. But by the same token, there's kind of a dark side to capitalism. One of the problems is that it hasn't worked particularly equitably across all aspects of society. There are a lot of issues regarding debt, national debt as well as personal debt. There are, of course, the famous scandals. And the lack of ethics and morality that led to the global financial crisis is what made me write the book. And if I could just start by saying I'm someone who spent most of his life in the corporate world. I did business at a very high level on six continents, working for multinational companies.
Yeah, so we're talking billion-dollar companies, from what I understand. You were working with billion-dollar companies, so you've seen the top end of this.
I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of capitalism on a global scale. And so that's why I wrote the book, because, frankly, if we do not bring ethics and morality back to the table, capitalism could self-destruct, and you're seeing some of the signs of discontent in the movements you mentioned. Let me give you some other really startling statistics. There was recently a poll done by the Harvard Politics Institute that showed that only 19% of millennials identified themselves as capitalists. That means 81% of millennials don't view themselves as capitalists. Now, only about 45% view themselves as socialists, but that middle ground, that shift, was unimaginable just a generation ago. And there's also a lot of confusion and misunderstanding about what do we mean by socialism? What's the difference between socialism and Marxism? I have a whole chapter in my book on Marxism, which is very different from socialism. And what is the proper place of the collective and the market in a pragmatic economy? So, you know, these are issues that the church traditionally has shied away from. But if we learned anything from the recent past, it's that when the church doesn't have a place at the table, morality often goes wanting. So that's what we don't want to happen.
Well, and I think this idea that it's possible that capitalism and democracy can sort of just reduce everyone down to whether they're efficient or whether they are unproductive and either discard or embrace based on that level really is where we take the soul out of capitalism, where we turn people into numbers and statistics and efficiency as opposed to seeing them as human beings. Is that part of the soullessness that you're trying to come out of over this maybe last 10-20-year cycle of capitalism?
That's exactly right. So, you know, ever since really 1970, when the famous Friedman Doctrine was made public by Milt Friedman, this notion that the only moral responsibility a corporate executive has is to make as much money as possible within the constraints of law and local custom. That has become the mantra of business schools, where, and by the way, I taught at one of the top business schools in the world in Oxford, business schools and boardrooms for two generations now. And what we're seeing is the fallacy of that thinking. And the reason why that thinking is bad is, one, it's based on a kind of misunderstanding of what Adam Smith referred to as the invisible hand. And really, it doesn't take into account the effects of time and what we really mean by local custom in terms of morality. And law itself is a very, very blunt instrument. So I often tell people that if we rely on things like legislation and regulation to bring morality into our economic system, we're kidding ourselves. Because legislation and regulation are what we default to when ethics fail, when morality fails. And we have a wonderful reservoir, by the way, in the United States especially, of spiritual capital, if you will. Going back to Adam Smith and Max Weber and other economic epics where people freely applied their Judeo-Christian beliefs to how they conducted business. And they treated people exactly that, as people. And they viewed economics as part of the social fabric, not something that sat outside of the other concerns we have as a society. So this postmodern capitalism, which is what I call our current system, is really devoid of a moral compass and resistant, if not impervious, to ethical constraint. And that's what we need to change.
Great stuff. And when you try to legislate morality, it becomes almost impossible. And that's where we are today. Great stuff from Ken Barnes. We'll take a short break and be back in a minute. Welcome back. We are talking to Dr. Ken Barnes, who has released a very compelling book called Redeeming Capitalism, incredibly timely with where we are in the country and this ongoing conversation about different economic systems. And one of the points you brought up before the break, Ken, was this idea that the greatest good a company leader can do is to make a lot of money. That's the greatest morality. And yet there's a soul that we lose if that's the pursuit. But is it really possible for business leaders who might, especially if they're in a publicly traded company and have to give their quarterly results and their jobs even dependent upon profitability and growth, is it possible for them to really embrace a soul that can be for the greater good of the people around them?
I would say at this point it's very difficult, which is why the book is so important and why changing the narrative is so important. Right now, there are fiduciary responsibilities that corporate executives have to maximize shareholder return. And it's very difficult to fight against that. But what we're seeing is a move away from that more to a stakeholder mentality. When you start thinking about business and economics as a stakeholder environment that involves entire communities and not just the pursuit of a particular return on invested capital, then you can start to look at how we run our businesses, how we share our profits, what it is we do inside of our communities, how we treat the environment. You know, it's interesting. One of the single greatest concerns, again, especially millennials have about the history of capitalism is the damage that's been done to the environment. And, we can no longer afford to pretend that economic progress hasn't been one of the reasons we've had degradation in the environment. It's just a fact, and we need to consider the impact on our futures. So let me give you a couple examples of companies that have done this. The Mars Corporation, the candy folks. Now, that's a privately held company, but it's a multi-billion-dollar company. they made the decision a while back that a certain return on investment was absolutely reasonable, and anything above that was greed. And they wanted to ensure that their entire supply chain, from the people who grow the cocoa beans all the way to the people who sell the products on the shelves, all made a fair return based on their contribution to the business. And it's called the economics of mutuality. And it has been radically successful. Everyone in the channel has succeeded. Now, in order to do that with a publicly traded company, we'd really have to start talking about changing the laws and changing the fiduciary responsibilities executives have. Now, you may not know this, but most of my career was actually spent in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain. There, they changed the law a while back. It's called the Companies Act, where they actually require the boards of directors to consider the impact of every decision they make on all stakeholders, not just shareholders. And it has changed the way companies think about decisions concerning opening or closing factories, laying people off, giving people wage increases, et cetera. And also there is a long-held historic tradition in capitalism that goes back again to the 18th century and the observations of Adam Smith that said American capitalism was always a much more generous form of capitalism, and that's why it succeeded, because workers, for instance, were paid a much higher proportion of corporate profits than they were in the UK during the Industrial Revolution. And that's one of the reasons why the American economy did better than the UK in the early days of capitalism. So there's history there to prove that if we are more generous in our economics, everybody will benefit more.
And this is an entirely different take than the common narrative that really what capitalism does at its core is it just creates this huge income gap and there's money grabs and everything going on, that's the heart of capitalism. But you are really reshaping that conversation. And we do have actually a millennial here in studio, and Logan, who we often invite in the conversation as well. And in terms of appealing to the next generation relative to capitalism, these reforms seem so important. Logan's got a question for you here, too, as we kind of have a couple minutes left in our time.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned how many millennials are saying that they support socialism as their choice for what form of financial world they want. However, I wonder how many could actually tell the definition of socialism. Instead, they're looking for, I think, a fair deal in the world, and that's how they think they're going to get it. I mean, if you told me to describe what socialism is, I think I could give you the bare bones of what the ideals are, but I don't know if I could tell you the actual step-by-step practices.
Well, you make a great point. And first of all, let me say part of the problem with the political discourse in our country right now is that there are people who, for their own purposes, are convoluting Marxism and socialism. And as soon as you say the word socialism, people get images of the Soviet Union and totalitarian economic systems that are completely controlled by the state. That's not socialism. Socialism is really a social construct. Not like any other social construct, where people who live in largely democratic societies, in Northern Europe particularly as an example, make the decision to use the tax system as a way of distributing wealth for the purposes of a greater influence of the collective, because they've decided that there are some things the collective does better than the market and things that the market does better than the collective. In our country, we tend to draw battlegrounds between the collective and the market. And we say the collective is bad because it's the state, and the market is good because it's individuals and private citizens. And that's just not a healthy narrative. The fact of the matter is, in most things, the market outperforms the collective. But there are some areas in the economy where actually we would do better to default to the collective because there is no natural equilibrium between supply and demand. And in those areas, we should look hard at how we can accomplish that. But even beyond that, just simple things like wages. You know, there's a lot of discussion about the so-called living wage, which is really the minimum wage brought to a level that ensures people can support families if they are in full-time employment. Now, a lot of people will criticize that and say it smacks of socialism. It isn't socialism at all. In fact, again, Adam Smith himself was a proponent of the living wage 250 years ago. And his argument was that if everybody participates fully in the success of capitalism, capitalism itself will do better in the long run. And so what we're seeing now, unfortunately, is a huge concentration of wealth in a smaller and smaller and smaller number of people at the very top, and the rest of society is feeling as though they're being left out. And the backlash, we will not like what replaces if we do not reform capitalism.
It's Ken Barnes, Dr. Ken Barnes of Gordon Conwell, releasing the book Redeeming Capitalism, such an important subject, especially as we're heading towards this midterm election cycle coming up, where I'm sure there's going to be a lot of sound bites and narrative around the subject. Ken, thank you so much for the time this morning.
It's my pleasure. God bless you.
Logan, I appreciate that conversation on the idea of redeeming capitalism. It's not as appealing, maybe. It doesn't create the kind of buzz that, you know, if we were to move towards socialism, but an important conversation nonetheless.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I can tell you why so many young people are interested in socialism. It's that capitalism gives them bad memories of losing at Monopoly with their older brothers and sisters. That's what it is.
You know, yeah, family game night never devolves more so than when you try to take each other's money in Monopoly or a little global domination and Risk, right? Those are the two games to avoid on family game night. Let's head to news. Best-selling author and apologist Lee Strobel is talking with us this morning about the need to combine both intellectual understanding of Jesus with actually experiencing him in life.
How does God personally encounter us? How does he change us? How does he transform us? I think that's a necessary but not sufficient kind of evidence. In other words, I think it's necessary because if God exists, you would think he would change our lives. But it's not sufficient in and of itself because other religions claim life change too. So I think it's an important part of the case. It hits more of the heart than the head perhaps, but I think nevertheless it's persuasive when we look at stories that are so amazing and so just staggering how God has transformed lives. You kind of step back and you say, oh, you know, only God could do this. So I think it ultimately does point toward God as the source of this transformation.
That is Lee Strobel speaking with us about just the power of the witness that we have when Jesus is transforming our lives. If you want to catch that entire interview, head to myfaithradio.com. You can search for Lee Strobel, The Case for Grace, Life Change, anything along those lines, and you'll find the entire segment. We will take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Ruth Kramer of Mission Network News to talk about the updates of the cave situation in Thailand, as well as some further information about missionaries around the world. So stay with us here on Faith Radio Mornings.
If Jesus chose to form friendships with the unacceptable of his time, should we do any less? This is Jim Garlow. On more than one occasion, I have contacted persons hostile to my values and asked them, "Will you give me an hour of your time to teach me how to relate to you?" I've never been turned down. Some may criticize me for it, but I have continued to reach out to those who have the greatest influence that I can reach to see if I can have at least a civil dialogue. I've discovered great value in it. Let me say this, however. It isn't just about forming friendships. It's about speaking truth, something in rather short supply in today's culture. Let us be like the prophets of old, willing to be misunderstood to bring correction to things that are out of line. Get the details at jimgarlow.com and be prepared to live out your faith. This is Jim Garlow.
To boldly go where no one has gone before.
I love that intro, Ruth. Just the Star Trek idea. I know we've talked about that theme on the show. Real glad for you to be joining us this morning again and talking through some of the headlines relative to missionaries around the world. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So I know you're just for our listeners, you're the executive producer and anchor of Mission Network News, and you come on with us, kind of give us a sense of what's happening globally, not just the news part of this, but how Christians are experiencing the news as they're ministering to the gospel around the world. And so lots of stories to get into, Ruth, including obviously the story out of Thailand, where these young boys are being rescued. The operation is going on right now as we speak. A fifth boy has emerged from the cave, which by my count leaves seven boys and the coach still behind to be rescued. What are you following in this, and what are you seeing in this story?
Well, I'm not sure how much you've already talked about how the boys got down there and, you know, what's been going on with all of the situation with the required rescue. But this is something that we've been following because one of the boys is actually a Compassion International sponsored child. And, you know, this is a big situation anyway because it's so unusual. But because now we've got, you know, one of our ministry partners that's intimately involved and concerned about a specific kind of child. There's a connection there with kingdom building. This is especially important. Now, the soccer team, has a number of boys on it between the ages of 11 and 16. The one kid that we're talking about specifically as Compassion sponsor child is 14 years old. He's in eighth grade, and he's been kind of a part of the program through the project at his home church. And it's just kind of he's a kid. He's a teenager. So he loves music. He loves guitar. He likes to play the piano. And he just accepted Christ in March. Mm. So this is something – he's the oldest of five siblings. And, you know, his family is involved with the local church as well because that's what Compassion does. They partner with an indigenous church to really try to help develop a community, bring in some of the things that encourage a community to thrive. So sometimes that's clean water. Sometimes that's a school. Sometimes that's more humanitarian situations, and sometimes they just bring in other things that the community is in need of, and what you see happening is building relationships, and people start to ask questions, and there becomes a transformational action, and it comes to the local church. So there's a local church involved in this situation because you have that connection with the Compassion sponsored child.
Hmm. And I know that they've been getting some limited messages out of the cave from time to time to parents and relatives or loved ones. Have the sponsors, have there been specific contact with the boy who's being sponsored by Compassion International?
At this point, they haven't said that they've had they haven't shared any messages from this child. But, you know, obviously the family is staying outside the area and just kind of waiting with the rest of the loved ones who are kind of being kept near but not so close that they're in the way of the rescue operation. Again, Compassion is letting us know kind of as the situation unfolds what's happening. In fact, one of our reporters just did an interview about 40 minutes ago with the Compassion-sponsored with the photojournalist who's been covering the situation. So we'll have an updated story actually on tomorrow's broadcast.
Hmm. You mentioned the great news that this young boy has accepted Jesus here just recently. What is sort of the faith atmosphere like in Thailand? Is this relatively unusual that somebody would start following Jesus? Tell us about what life is like religiously in this country.
Thailand is Buddhist, so there's a lot of culture that comes with this. So to become a Christian in Thailand means you're going to reject a lot of other things. You're going to move away from what is considered a cultural norm. And it's not something without its risk, but it's not going to be something where you face the same kind of reaction in terms of the strong reaction as you might in a Muslim-dominant country. To become a follower of Christ in Thailand means you're probably going to face some difficulty from your own community. So from your family members, from your friends who don't understand necessarily why you've decided to change in the situation. But there is support in Thailand. There's a lot of, I want to say, kingdom building work because there are ministries that are invested in Thailand to come alongside the growing body of Christ there.
Yeah, and you mentioned too just the implications it might have if your family, if you decide to start following Jesus. And it's a different context, right, Ruth, in Thailand versus someplace in a Western culture like the United States where it's almost like these individual choices and live and let live kind of idea. But in Thailand, there's a real familial dimension. And so it does have a different kind of impact if one member of the family chooses a different way of faith. Does that sound about right for Thailand's context?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about in terms of the percentage of evangelical followers of Christ in Thailand, it's like 0.5%. So it's not something that is a – there's a lot to overcome when you publicly identify yourself as a follower of Christ. There is a body of Christ. It is growing, and there are supports in place for those people. Ministries are heavily invested there, as I said. But it's just a kind of a situation when you have a follower of someone who becomes a Christian, there's a lot that changes for that person. And sometimes the isolation, if they don't have a lot of continuous support, can be something where the pressure gets to be pretty intense. So, you know, for a kid like this, he's one of, you know, a group of people who is a follower of Christ. The rest of them are Buddhist. In fact, the coach that led them down there as part of a team building exercise, the coach that led them down there is a monk. So he's been kind of encouraging the boys to meditate, to try to keep people calm. And, you know, the whole thing that has been going on down there in a crisis situation puts a lot of pressure on a baby Christian. So, you know, just be praying for this kid's faith, that Jesus makes himself real to him, that, you know, he's able to be the light of Christ to his fellow teammates, to the coach. That there's an opportunity to talk about his new faith, and that he's given the supernatural opportunities to be wise in his responses, because this is all new for him. You know, he's only been a believer since March. So you imagine yourself in a situation like that.
Yeah, it's incredible. And sometimes it feels like a world away from us here in the States. But this is where partnering with an organization like Compassion International is, that we actually can have an impact to somebody, on somebody who may be feeling a bit lonely or isolated if they're walking on a different journey than the people around them.
Right, right. So, again, you know, as Compassion International is following this situation, they are asking people to pray. We've brought out a couple of different aspects about how we can be praying, not only for the rest of the boys as they're coming out of the cave. This is a very dangerous operation. We do know that the risks have been underscored by the death of the Navy SEAL. You know, the following days, we've been praying that maybe the rain would lessen so that you wouldn't have to deal with the ongoing flooding. And they've actually had a break in the weather. So, you know, this is something that's just, we're asking people to continue to pray. This is a situation that has been gaining more followers, I guess I could say, as it's been unfolding, because it's so unusual.
That's great stuff. It's Ruth Kramer from Mission Network News. And Ruth, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about a different conversation, and that is a missionary who is imprisoned in Turkey right now. Pretty sensitive situation, but we'd love your update on some of the mechanics that are going on, as even United States Congress might be getting involved, and what we can anticipate moving forward. Faith Radio Mornings, we'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. It is 11 minutes before the top of the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Peter Kapsner, and we are joined on the line by Ruth Kramer, who is the executive producer and anchor of Mission Network News, and she comes on regularly to give us a little different spin on the news and understand maybe some of what's happening from a Christian perspective, a missionary perspective, from these headlines around the world. And Ruth, before we get into the story in Turkey, I have to ask, Logan and I were talking a little earlier about family game night, and we decided that Monopoly and Risk are two games that you should probably stay away from on family game night, just because they devolve into fighting and you know, this fracture in the family. Do you have game night? Do you have any suggestions about this?
In our family, we like word games a lot.
Yeah.
Our whole family tends to be very strong with those types of things. When we start playing strategy games, I personally can't keep my attention centered long enough to stick with the game. So if you actually want to beat me in a game, it'll be a strategy game, because I will just kind of wander away from it and have no idea what's actually going on. And I'll just start throwing things on the table just to see what happens.
Don't worry, Ruth. Anything more complicated than Connect Four gets me in trouble.
I can see exactly one move ahead in chess most of the time, and that's about as far as it gets. Hey, yeah. Great. So heading into the Turkey conversation, I know that there is some events happening with the missionary, Andrew Brunson, a really interesting story. He has been jailed under potentially false pretenses, accused of terrorism and espionage. And it's a pretty sensitive situation, as we said, but there's maybe some hope. What can you tell us without divulging too much information to put the situation at risk?
Well, part of the reason we're talking about this today is because his trial is going to be resuming again on July 18th. And so there's a lot of things that are happening, lobbying that's happening behind the scenes. And so anything that we're talking about right now, we're going to be generating, you know, really to ask people to pray about the situation. There have been some situations where stories have come out with, you know, hopes and dreams about what's actually going to happen as a result of the July 18th hearing. And a lot of ministries that have been busy behind the scenes lobbying on Brunson's behalf are basically saying, until it happens, it's a rumor. So they're not really trying to feed into any of that kind of stuff, regardless of what you're reading in print right now. The situation, though, it has gotten a lot of attention internationally. So you have had, like, members of parliament in the European Union. On May 4th, I think, 50 members of the European Parliament submitted a letter to President Erdogan calling for Andrew's release. So now you have, you know, a lot of attention from Europe that's coming into this. U.S. Congress has done quite a lot, actually, to lobby for his release. In fact, last week, Senator Jeanne Shaheen out of New Hampshire traveled to Turkey and met with Andrew Brunson and personally lobbied Erdogan for his release as following the trial on July 18th. And she's basically joining the company of, I think, Lindsey Graham and a number of other members of Congress who have had separate meetings with Erdogan to try to lobby on behalf of Andrew Brunson. So he's been in jail since October of 2016. He's facing anywhere between 35 years in prison and a life imprisonment sentence for essentially state crimes, terrorism, espionage, and all that kind of stuff. He's been accused of being a member of the PKK, which is a terrorist organization in Turkey. And of course, you know, he's offended by these kinds of things. And when he has the opportunity to respond to the charges, he says they're false accusations. His job primarily for the last 20 years has been to be a pastor of a church in Turkey. And he's been kind of a political pawn since his arrest and being charged with these state crimes. It's a situation where it is really created some tension between the U.S. and Turkey. And now you've got things that are, you know, built into bills. You've got an amendment that's connected to the National Defense Authorization Act. So it's really picked up a lot of steam as people are watching this situation and trying to lobby for his release, because it's pretty clear to people who look at the situation and the legalities of it that these are false accusations. So for the number of organizations that are trying to work on his behalf, like Middle East Concern, you've got International Christian Concern, Voice of the Martyrs, Open Doors, among other organizations that want to stay kind of behind the scenes, and you've got members of Congress that are going in. Those people who are also followers of Christ are asking some specific things for prayer. Obviously, we want the truth to come out, and we want his release to be part of that. While he's been in jail, he's had opportunities to continue to do the things that pastors do, to encourage people, to share the hope of Christ, to live the hope of Christ in places where he may not be able to actually share the gospel in a traditional sense. So, you know, as far as prayer goes, ask God to continue to strengthen him, strengthen his family, that they will all know God's peace and his presence. Imagine yourself being in a jail cell. You know, your health is now in question as far as the damage that has occurred living in a situation like that. The uncertainty of really not knowing how the administration is going to play this next move. So just being unpredictable. And that takes a lot of toll on your health, because it's stressful. So just ask that, you know, God's peace and presence is part of this, that it'll be obvious that he's been detained unjustly, that the Turkish court will uphold justice and reject the allegations of the involvement. That the president of Turkey would not abuse his rights by using him as leverage, you know, that actually in an honor-shame culture, that is what Turkey is. The president really needs to be able to save face to be able to pull out of something like this. So, you know, praying that the advisors that are part of all of the lobbying discussions will be creative enough to be able to figure out how to do that. You know, this is something where God can just reach in and bam, do something amazing. But if it takes some of the machinations that God would give those people in those positions, the creativity to come up with a solution that allows, you know, for the release of Andrew Brunson. So we're praying for a lot of these things.
That's great stuff, Ruth. And it is just a reminder of how much easier we can often have it in the States, where it's just we're not at risk of being in prison just for speaking up for our faith. I appreciate you coming on this morning and giving us a different spin on these headlines. I love hearing about what our Christian brothers and sisters are up to around the world.
Thank you for having us, and thank you for so much for just really encouraging people to be thinking in terms of kingdom building stuff with the news.
I love it, Ruth. Thanks. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon. It is 3 minutes before the top of the hour. We'll take a break and wrap up this first hour of the show. What a great conversation with Ruth, and just getting a sense that of being in prison for the gospel. Logan, during the interview, you were typing me some notes asking the question, rhetorically, I think, do we know of anyone who had good come from being imprisoned?
Well, gee, there is obviously the story of Paul and all the good works he was able to do in prison with the guards and what it turned out to be in the end. I mean, there's no doubt that being imprisoned is a terrifying and difficult thing, especially in a foreign country. But it's so encouraging to hear from Ruth that he's still doing good works, that he's able to minister in these prisons and make the best of a hard situation.
Yeah, great stuff. Great first hour of the show. Really just appreciated hearing about redeeming capitalism as well as the news from around the world. We'll take a break for the top of the hour, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Andreas and Margaret Kostenberger and talk about parenting.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.